start this morning by asking something that has absolutely nothing to do with what we're going to talk about. Whether you saw the conversation that Matt Damon is supposed to have had this week with somebody. They've got a new movie coming out that George Clooney put together. Matt Damon stars in it, and they're trying to have publicity for this thing. And Damon says that during the filming, George Clooney, who was in charge of everything, had charge of the wardrobe. And they were all having to get in shape because they were all supposed to act like soldiers and run and do all these stunts and stuff. And he had the costume people, the wardrobe people, take Matt Damon's wardrobe and every day took it in by a 16th of an inch. So he was doing all this exercise and all this kind of stuff, and the clothes kept getting tighter and tighter. I think somebody's doing a Clooney on me, and I just wanted to report that, just in case some of you need to have an explanation for things that were happening where you are. Secondly, there's something that ran across the desk this week. If you have a friend who is OCD, or if you yourself have tendencies in that direction, they have 25 pictures that will drive someone OCD absolutely bonkers. And the one that is my personal favorite is a clear plastic wrapped stack of Fig Newtons, all of which are turned the same way except the third one up. Yes, I want to straighten that out. So those of you who pay attention to detail of where patterns and all that, I'll try to do that. But it is an outstanding set of pictures. Apparently Heinz sells these squeeze bottles. They had three squeeze bottles lined up. One was pickles, one was ketchup, one was mustard. Two of them, if you read the label, the thing points down. The third one, if you read the label, it points up. And they're all standing there like that. It drives me nuts.
Did you ever see the show Monk? Anybody see the
show? Oh, yeah. That would be full of that kind of thing.
You know what my nickname is for Jack? Mrs. Monk.
Okay. Well, that's just for fun, for what it's worth. Okay. I told you a couple of weeks ago we were walking into a swamp, and today we go into it full bore. This is ugly, horrible, with few redeeming features, but I think for you to get some sense of what God was seeing in these people, you need to have a sense of sort of what the details are. So that's what we're going to try to go into today. I'm going to do something for you that I forgot to do for the first hour. And what I want to do is I want you to look in 2 Kings, chapter 8 is where we're going to start. And I want you to take a look for a moment at chapter 11 of 2 Kings. There's nothing particular I'm going to have you look at there. But if you start at chapter 11 in 2 Kings, through the rest of 2 Kings, there's almost no mention of the nation of Israel. The northern kingdom is almost not mentioned. The only mention you get of the northern kingdom is just for a moment when Assyria comes in and wipes them out. It's just a moment that. From chapter 11 on, the focus is on Judah and what happens with Judah. If you go to 2 Chronicles, if you go to 2 Chronicles, when you get to chapter 25, I think it is, and it may have actually started a little bit earlier than that. I guess it's more like chapter 21. When you get to chapter 21, most of the focus is on Judah from there on. It's not exactly that God is giving up on Israel, although that's probably one way you could say it. But it is that the attention of the writer has been, in 2 Kings, focused on what's been happening in Israel. And somewhere right in here, that focus shifts. If you remember the list of prophets, if you didn't get one, there's one in one of the chairs up there. The first couple of prophets, the first few prophets, all came to the northern kingdom. And then it's like it was just cut off, and all the other prophets came to Judah. That's reflective of this transition. And I thought before we started that I would point that out. Secondly, I want to remind you of what I've been reminding you of each week. In 1 Kings chapter 19, this is quite a ways back, Elijah was running for his life from Jezebel. God had ministered to him over a period of 40 days or more. And at the end of that process, Elijah cries out to God, "You might as well just kill me. I'm the only one left." And God tells him, "No, there's at least 7,000 who are still with you." And that probably is a 7,000 in biblical sense, that 7 is a complete number and thousands are lots. It may not be the exact 7,000 as opposed to 7,001. But I think it may be a little more symbolic than that. But at that same time, in between his cry and God's mentioning, "You're not alone," he gives him instructions on things to do. There were three things he was supposed to do. I'm not asking you to tell me in order in which they're listed in 1 Kings 19. I want you to tell me instead in order of the importance of which one gets done first and which one gets done second. What are the three things he was supposed to do? Number one, appoint Elisha to be successor to him, and therefore to be servant and apprentice to him until Elijah was taken away. At the point where we are, Elijah is gone. He's been taken away in the whirlwind. So the other two tasks remain to be done. What are those two tasks? Anoint a new king of Aram, which is the country north and east, primarily north and east of Israel, and anoint a new king for Israel. And he names the two persons that are going to be so anointed. For Aram, it was Hazael. And for Israel, it was Jehu. Okay? Where we were last time, we finished 2 Kings 8, verse 15. The second of those instructions has just been completed. Hazael was an official in the court of Ben-Hadad. We called him Benny, because we didn't want to necessarily pronounce that every time. But he was in the court, and Ben-Hadad had fallen desperately ill. He heard that Elijah had actually come to Damascus. This was the prophet they'd been trying to kill just a short time before, and here he shows up in Damascus. And the king hears of this and says, "Hazael, go find out from him if I'm going to survive." Hazael comes to Elijah and says, "My master wants to know, will he survive?" And Elijah says, "No, he's going to die, but why don't you go back and tell him that he's going to survive? Maybe that's a good thing to do." And then he tells him, it says he went into a trance almost, looked at him fixedly and began to weep. "Why are you weeping?" "Because I've seen all the things you're going to do to Israel." If you read the list, it's in verse 12 of 2 Kings 8. The list of what he's going to do is horrible. And horrible is perhaps even too mild a word for it. And Hazael says, "How am I going to do all these things?" And he says, "Because God's going to make you king of Aram." And he goes back and kills Ben-Hadad after telling him, "Oh yeah, you're going to survive." And then when he goes to sleep, kills him and takes over. So for a period of time now, Hazael is going to be the king of Aram. And he's going to be a source of constant problems, especially for Israel, but later on for Judah as well. I want you to keep an eye on that. So we're picking up at verse 16, and we're going to have to pause immediately. In verse 16, in my translation, it says, "In the fifth year of Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel." Now remember, any time they start talking about so-and-so is king of Judah, they always put it against the backdrop of who's king of Israel. Anytime they talk about who's king of Israel, they put it against the backdrop of who's king of Judah. So it starts out, "In the fifth year of Jehoram, king of Ahab, son of Ahab, king of Israel, Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat, became king of Judah." Now, I don't think yours says it that same way. I think yours has a difference. Does yours have a difference?
Jehoshaphat was king of Judah.
In some translations, at least one of these two names is Joram, not Jehoram. Okay, mine says Jehoram in both places. Jehoram is king of Israel, and Jehoram becomes king of Judah. That's not the same person. It's two different people with the same name. And you got to watch out for this. In some translations, it's called Joram, J-O-R-A-M. In other translations, they insert an E-H in the English spelling between the J and the O, and it becomes Jehoram. And it turns out that seems to show up a lot. There's even a couple of chapters in which the same name is written one way here, and about three verses later it's written the other way. It's real hard to keep track. I've been warning you all along that this is coming. Here's another place. Mine says Jehoram in both places. Jennifer, does yours say Jehoram in both places? It says Joram in one and Jehoram, the other. Right.
Bill Nye says it's like it's two people, though.
It is two people. It is two people.
Okay, gotcha.
In my translation, those two people have the same name.
Okay,
interestingly enough, if you ignore last names, you and I have the same name. Sorry about that. I'm sorry about that. It's a curse that I bear. But
I thought you were Billy.
Well, I used to be, but nobody's supposed to know that.
Me too.
And I used to be something else, and you're never going to know that. So here we are. Jehoram, or Joram, is king, son of Ahab, king of Israel. How old was he when the focus is on the king of Judah? So this is going to be a part that focuses on Judah. How old was Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat, when he became king of Judah?
32.
And how long did he reign?
8 years.
So he ended his reign at the age of 40. Okay, that seems like an awful young age to retire. Do you think he retired? No, I think he died. Verse 18, he followed the example of the kings of Israel. This is the king of Judah, right? This is the king of the southern kingdom. He's following the examples of the kings of the northern kingdom of Israel, especially the house of Ahab. He's doing what they've been doing. And why was this?
Married
one of Ahab's daughters. And he did what is displeasing to the Lord. There's a judgment of the writer, of the historian, that God has inspired here. Mine says he did what's displeasing to the Lord. If you have a list of the kings over here, you'll see a D next to his name for displeased. Okay? Verse 19, but God remembered David, so he wasn't willing yet to take him off the throne. Verse 20, you can see the decline of the country coming. They have been dominating Edom. Edom has been sending them tribute. Edom throws that off. And if you read more carefully, it sounds like the king of Judah tried to go in and reverse that and didn't get very far. And then in verse 23 and 24, it says, the usual things that you find at the end of one of these things, is not his history recorded in the book of the kings of Judah? We don't have that. And then he fell asleep with his ancestors. His son Ahaziah succeeded him. That's all you get on him. So far, okay? Question. All right. Verse 25. In the 12th year of Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, back in verse 16, it was the 5th year. Now it's the 12th year. So 8 years have gone by, or 7 years have gone by, something like that. Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of Judah, became king. How old was he when he became king? 22. I'm in verse 26 of 2 Kings 8. How long did he reign?
1 year.
1 year. And then the next verse is a little odd. It tells you his mother's name. What's his mother's name?
Athaliah.
Athaliah, we'll say today. You can say something else tomorrow, but today we're going to say Athaliah. And it says that she was granddaughter of Omri, but you already know that she was the daughter of Ahab, because I told you just a little bit before that Ahaziah's father, Jehoram, or Joram, had married Ahab's daughter. And this was the succession. How did things go for Ahaziah? Not any better. He did things that displeased the Lord. He was doing what the house of Ahab was doing, and he was related to them by marriage. And then it says in verse 28, he went with Jehoram, son of Ahab, to make war on Hazael, king of Aram. That's a stupid thing to do. And at the end of this thing, what happens? You got Jehoram is still king of Israel. Ahaziah is now king of Judah. They're going together to make war on Hazael. How did that go? Not only did it not go well, Jehoram of Israel was injured in the process. And when the chapter ends, where is he? Jehoram is in Jezreel, recovering from his wounds. And what happens with Ahaziah? Ahaziah goes to visit. Ahaziah's mother would be the aunt of this other person, because they're one's out of Ahab's line. Okay, so everything's really cozy. Okay, and that's about all you see there. Right? Now, there's more going on, and we're going to go pick this up later. But let's pause and take a look at this for just a second, because all of a sudden, chapter 9, verse 1, the scene shifts, and the scene shifts in an interesting way. The scene shifts back to Elisha. You haven't seen much of Elisha for the last little while. shifts back to Elisha, and it says he summoned a member of the prophetic brotherhood to him. You've been noticing in other places that where Elijah and Elisha were, there were these companies, these towns or villages that had groups of prophets in them, more than 50 in at least one of those places. He says to this member of the prophetic brotherhood, hitch up your clothes. What is that purpose of that?
Get ready to go
and to go fast. Take this flask of oil, go to Ramoth in Gilead. When you arrive there, look for Jehu, son of Jehoshaphat, son of Nimshi. Now, pause for a second. I think the order, let me double check and make sure, was our Jehoshaphat, the one that my granddaddy's mule was named after, was the son of Asa, and he was in Judah. This is a guy who's in Israel, in the northern kingdom. So the fact that his daddy's named Jehoshaphat just gives us that much more confusion, but that's a different Jehoshaphat. Granddaddy's name was Nimshi. When you find him, tell him to get up and leave his companions, take him into an inner room, take the flask of oil that I've given you, pour it over his head, and say this: the Lord says this, I've anointed you king of Israel, open the door and run for your life. Is that roughly what it says?
Don't delay.
Flee as fast as you can, my translation says. The young man left for Ramoth in Gilead. When he arrived, he found the senior officers of the army sitting together. I have a message for you, commander, he said. For which of us, said Jehu? For you, commander, he answered. Jehu got up, went into the house with him. The young man poured the oil on his head, and he said a little bit more than it was recorded for Elisha to say. So Elisha must have given him more instructions that weren't recorded. The Lord God of Israel says this, I've anointed you king of the Lord's people of Israel. And your first task is to wipe out Ahab's family. This is a grisly task. This is part of the swamp we're in. This is awful. People are going to die. God says, you're to strike down the family of Ahab, your master. I will avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and all of Lord's servants on Jezebel and on the whole family of Ahab. I will destroy every man-jack of Ahab's family. If you need to know what man-jack means, go look it up someplace else. I'm not going to disturb the tranquility of this room by explaining that particular word to you. Fettered or free in Israel, I'm going to make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, son of Ahijah. Three times now, and I think there's something significant in three times. Three times the Lord has brought somebody to the throne of Israel, and that person has fallen off the rails so badly that he wipes out that entire family, puts somebody else on. He's done that with Jeroboam, wiped him out because he set up the golden calves, put up Baasha, has taken him out, and now he's about to do that for Ahab. Elijah prophesied this way back when. Do you remember the context in which that prophecy was given? Ahab had coveted something. What did he covet?
Land.
He wanted somebody's vineyard to put in a little truck farm. He wanted his carrots and tomatoes close by the palace wall in Jezreel. And he wanted the land. The guy said, this is ancestral land. The Bible says I'm not allowed to sell it. And so Ahab went and pouted. Do you remember this? Turned his face to the wall, wouldn't eat. Jezebel said, what's got you so upset? And he tells her, she goes out and has Naboth killed. He says, go take the land. And about that time, either Elijah or one of the prophets came in and said, your blood's going to be spilled in that field. Jezebel's going to die right here. And remember, all that was right up against the palace. So it was all right there. And that's what he's talking to. As for Jezebel, verse 10, well, this is kind of grisly. What's going to happen? Dogs are going to eat her, and there's not going to be enough left to bury her. And with that, the member of the prophetic brotherhood opened the door and made his escape. Now, pause for a minute. Think about if you're Jehu. You've just gone inside with this guy that you've never seen before. He's poured oil on your head. He's said these wonderful, interesting things that require you to rebel against the king and become the king yourself. And you've got all these army commanders that are right outside the door. You walk back outside, and the master's officials said, is all well, they ask him. Why did this madman come to you? The guy must have looked a little crazy when he ran out the door like he did. Oh, you know that fellow. You know how he talks, he answered. Evasion, they cried. Did yours have that word? Mine has the word evasion, they cried. Come on, tell us. And he replied, well, he said this and he said that. And then he said, the Lord says this, I've anointed you king of Israel. And at that, they took their cloaks and spread them under him on the bare steps. They sounded the trumpet and they shouted. What did they shout?
Jehu
is king. But he's not king yet. Who's king? This is Israel. Keep track of who's who.
Jehoram.
Where's Jehoram?
In the bed.
He's in the bed. Where?
In Jezreel,
which is where Naboth's field was, right? And he's licking the wounds that Hazael had given him. Remember Elisha's prophecy back in 1 Kings 19? Those who escape the sword of Hazael will die by the sword of Jehu. That's coming true. Verse 14, Jehu, son of Jehoshaphat, son of Nimshi, plotted against Jehoram. And for the next verse or so, it reminds you of where the various players are. End of verse 15, Jehu says to those other guys, if you agree, let no one leave the town to go and take this news to Jezreel. And he mounted his chariot and left for Jezreel. And then it reminds you, Jehoram had taken his bed there. Ahaziah had gone down to visit him. They're both right there. Verse 17, what happens? Who do we meet? Who do we see? There's a lookout. Lookout on the towers of Jezreel. And what does he see? He sees Jehu's troop approaching. Does he know it's Jehu's troop? Not yet. He shouts out, I see a body of men. And Jehoram gave the order, have a horseman sent to meet them and ask, is all well? So the horseman went, met Jehu, and said, the king asks, is all well? What does it have to do with you, whether all is well? Jehu says, fall in behind me. And the lookout shouted to the king, the messenger has reached them, but he's not coming back. And the king said, send another one. He sends a second one. He gets up there. The king asks, is all well? Jehu says, what does that have to do with you, whether all is well? Fall in behind me. And about this time, the lookout says, and I think this is one of the most magnificent moments. It has nothing to do with spiritual content. I just think it's funny. The lookout says, he's reached them too, and he's not coming back. And you know, this guy drives like Jehu. King James says, for he driveth furiously. I can remember when I first got my driver's license, my father took me aside and said, the one thing I don't want you to do is drive like Jehu. I knew what he was talking about. Verse 21. First word in my translation, Jehoram shouts, harness. Yours may say, get ready. But if there's at least one that says hitch up.
Hitch up.
And they hitch up his chariot, and they hitch up his horses. And Jehoram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, each in his chariot, set out to meet Jehu. And the way the text evolves, the way the text presents this, Jehoram gets there first. Ahaziah is still trailing a little bit. It took a little longer to get his chariot ready. They reached Jehu where?
On the piece of ground that belonged.
In the field that used to belong to Naboth in Jezreel. As soon as Jehoram saw Jehu, he asked, is all well, Jehu? That's the question he sent his horsemen to ask. What a question, Jehu replied. When all the while the prostitutions and countless sorceries of your mother Jezebel go on. And at this, Jehoram wheeled and fled, shouting to Ahaziah. What does he shout?
Treachery.
Treason, he shouts in my translation. Treachery in yours. Treason, Ahaziah. But Jehu had drawn his bow. Now, you see Jehoram had made a 180. Have you seen cars do that in some of the movies? You know, they're going down the road this way and they're doing 180. Jehu had drawn his bow, struck Jehoram between the shoulder blades. The arrow went through the king's heart and he sank down in his chariot. Pick him up, Jehu said to his equerry, and he names him. Throw him into the field of Naboth, and he reminds the equerry of the prophecy. Throw him in the field. That's what the Lord declared should happen. Verse 27, what happens with Ahaziah? He sees what happens to Jehoram, and he takes off. And it says Jehu went in pursuit of him. Basically, we got Tony Stewart in pursuit of me. Jehu went in pursuit. Strike him down too, he said. They wounded him in his chariot. He took refuge in Megiddo, and there he died. His servants carried him in a chariot to Jerusalem, and they buried him in a tomb in the city of David. Ahaziah had become king of Judah in the 11th year of Jehoram, son of Ahab. How grisly so far?
Pretty bad.
Gets worse.
Gets worse.
Verse 30, what happens? He goes back to Jezreel. Jezebel was told what had happened, because they could probably see it from there. All this was real close by the palace. And verse 30 is stunning. What does Jezebel do?
Gets dolled up.
Gussied was my word too. You said dolled up, and that would be another one. Gussied up is what I remember my mother saying sometimes, not about herself, but about people that she observed. Mine says she made up her eyes with mascara. I have no idea whether mascara existed by that name back then, but it would be a modern name for it. She adorned her head, and she appeared at the window. As Jehu came through the gate, she shouted out, "How did Zimri get on after killing his master?" She's saying to Jehu, "You just killed a king. You just killed two kings." Think about what happens to people who kill kings in the history of this place. Jehu pays no attention to her. He instead looks up at the window and says, "Anybody up there on my side?" And there's two officials step out and look at him. He says, "Throw her down." And they did. And she died right there. And what's worse, what did Jehu do?
The horses trampled the horses.
Trampled her with his horses in his chariot. And what did he do then? He went in and had a meal. And after a while, he said, "You know, this woman was the daughter of a king. Why don't you go give her a burial?" And when they got back out there, they couldn't find enough to bury. And they told him so when he again remembered the prophecy. Found anything spiritually uplifting yet? Me neither, but we got to go through this swamp. Get to the other side, we got to go through. Chapter 10. There were 70 of Ahab's sons living in Samaria. He's in Jezreel. Samaria's in another place. Jehu sent to Samaria to the authorities of the city, to the elders and the guardians. And he says, I didn't go over this in detail in the first hour. He says, "Get yourself ready to fight. Put one of those 70 kids in charge and you follow them." And they write back and said, "We don't think that's such a good idea. You got any other idea?" He says, "Yeah, send me their heads. Choose one of them as your leader or kill them all." They send him baskets with the heads of those 70 people in it. They probably weren't all children. They were being taught by the elders of the city. That takes you through verse 11. Verse 12, he's now ready to go to Samaria. On the way, he meets Ahaziah's brothers. Yours says relatives, which might be more likely. Relatives might be a better translation. Mine says brothers, but it's got a footnote that says it's brothers in an extended sense of that term. And I don't know if there's a shaded meaning in the original. "Who are you?" he says. "We're relatives of Ahaziah. We're on our way to pay respects to the king's sons and the queen mother's sons. Take them alive," he said, and he took them to a well and slaughtered them. How many were there?
42.
Leaving there, he came on Jehonadab, son of a certain person, who was on his way to meet him, that is Jehu. Jehu greeted him and said, "Is your heart true to mine as my heart is to you?" And Jehonadab said, "Yes." "Well, if so," Jehu said, "give me your hand." And he brought him up into his chariot. And he says this sentence, "Come with me and witness my zeal for the Lord." And he heads for Samaria. What happens when he gets to Samaria? I'm now at verse 17, last half. He kills everybody in Ahab's family in Samaria. He destroyed, mine says, it. Meaning Ahab's family. Verse 18, he assembles all the people, and what does he say? Tells you about three verses later, this is a trick. He says, "Ahab did quite a service for Baal. I'm going to do an even bigger one. I'm going to have sacrifices to Baal, and I want everybody who's devoted to Baal to be here. And they went into the temple of Baal, and they got everyone in there. And he went in with Jehonadab, and he says to them, is everybody who's devoted to Baal in here? I don't want anybody devoted to the Lord. I want everybody who's devoted to Baal. Anybody who's not here, they're going to die if they're not here. He gets them all in. He offers sacrifices to Baal. He steps outside and says to the 80 armed soldiers outside, kill them all. And they kill them all, destroy the temple, and Baal worship ends in Israel. It's getting to where you can't walk around without blood on your ankles from all the blood they're spilling.
Where was this built?
This was in Israel, in Samaria. They started in Jezreel, which you might think of as the modern parallel might be Kennedy going to Martha's Vineyard.
Right.
So this would be sort of coming to the capital city from the vacation house. So Jezreel had a palace where they spent some time, but the capital was Samaria. So this was in Samaria.
Jerusalem.
In the northern kingdom. Uh-huh. In the northern kingdom. Now remember what I told you a little while ago. Starting in chapter 11, what happens? Oh, you've forgotten already. The focus is almost completely on Judah. So you get just a little bit more talking about Israel. Verse 28. In that way, Jehu rid Israel of Baal. But even so, Jehu did not give up the sins into which Jeroboam had led Israel. He didn't take down the golden calf. He left them up. Verse 30, the Lord said to Jehu, you've done well in carrying out what pleases me. You've done everything I required to be done to the house of Ahab. Your sons will occupy the throne of Israel down to the fourth generation. Why not forever? Because he hadn't gotten rid of the golden calves. He hadn't really turned back. Jehu did not faithfully and wholeheartedly follow the law of God. There's the judgment of the historian in verse 31. Verse 32. Starting at this time, the Lord began to do something to Israel. Mine has an interesting verb. It says whittle down. Yours may say reduce. Yours says cut off. If cut away might have been a better way of translating that, I think, to fit with the things I see in other translations. And who are the groups that start to be taken away? And who by? It says, all the territory east of the Jordan, and who took it? Hazael, the king of Aram. And it says, verse 34, 35, 36, Jehu died, his son Jehoahaz succeeded him. How long had he reigned in Israel? 28 years.
So that, when they, under Joshua, when they crossed the river Jordan to go into the promised land, this is the land that those tribes wanted to keep east of the Jordan, right?
And if you remember back in Judges and Joshua, especially in Joshua, Joshua said, okay, this is land on this side of the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan, that's going to belong to these tribes, but you have to go in and help everybody else. And when everything is done, then you come back and take the land. So this is Transjordan, from the east side of the Jordan River, and it names some of those tribes.
But now there. They've lost that land.
Yeah. And mine uses the term, the Lord began to whittle Israel down. And I think you said cut off, but cut away might be a little better. Reduce. Starting to reduce. Okay. Now, almost everything else talks about what happens in Judah. I want to pause at this point, and if you'll go with me over to 2 Chronicles. When we find things that we've already seen, we're going to skip past it. But we're going to slow down when we see new things. So I'm going to go first to chapter 21 of Chronicles. 2 Chronicles, chapter 21. If you back up to chapter 20, verse 35, that's just about three verses. It talks about Jehoshaphat forming a partnership with Ahaziah, king of Israel. We've got Jehoram in two places. We've got Ahaziah in two places. We've got Jehoshaphat in two places. There's just different people having the same name. It gets really confusing. But in any event, chapter 21, verse 1, Jehoshaphat falls asleep, and his son, mine says Jehoram here, just like it did back in 2 Kings. What does yours say there? Does it still say Joram?
Which verse are you on?
I'm on verse 1 of chapter 21.
Jehoram.
So yours has the EH inserted, right? That same person as Joram that you saw if you had that translation earlier. I wish I knew.
Y E or E Y, E H or H E, male or female?
Could be. I don't know. I should have looked that up, but I didn't think to do that. Yeah. Chapter 21, verse 2, Jehoram's brothers, sons of Jehoshaphat, names them. Do you see them? Verse 3, their father had lavished on those sons presents of silver and gold and other valuables, and they had each been given a fortified town or two in Judah. But the throne was bequeathed to Jehoram because he was the firstborn. What was in Jehoshaphat's mind? What was his plan? I'm going to put my eldest son on the throne. I'm going to put my other sons into specific important cities across the area. They're all going to have lots of resources to do the things they need to do, and together they will manage things for the country in wonderful ways. That was his plan. Verse 4, how did it go?
Not good.
Why?
He killed
Jehoram killed all of them immediately. Unbelievable. He was 32 when he came to the throne. He reigned for 8 years in Jerusalem. We've seen all that. Verse 8, Edom threw off the domination of Judah. We've seen that. Verse 12, we haven't seen. Long about this time, Jehoram, this is Jehoram, king of Israel, came across something written by the prophet Elijah. I think Elijah has already gone by this point, so I think it must have been something Elijah left, but I don't have a good sense of timing here. Maybe this was something Elijah sent to him just before he was taken away. There was a paper that he sent, or that came to him, written by Elijah, and the paper said, "The Lord, the God of your ancestor David, says this, you've not followed the example of your father Jehoshaphat or Asa, king of Judah." So let's back up and make sure where we are. This is Jehoram Israel, not Jehoram Judah, not Jehoram Israel. I got confused on that for just a moment. It says in verse 5, he was king in Jerusalem. So this is the Judah. You haven't followed the example of Jehoshaphat or Asa. You've followed the example of the kings of Israel because you've been influenced by Ahab and his family. Therefore, verse 14, the Lord is going to afflict your people, your sons, your wives, and all your property with a great calamity, and you yourself will have a severe disease of
the bowels.
It basically says your bowels are going to fall out.
Howard, you want to describe it?
I'm glad that we have Howard here today to help us with the details of this. My translation uses the word protrusion, which I think might mean herniated, this or that, but I don't know that I'm using the term right. In any event, it's going to be bad, and nobody's going to fix it. Verse 16, the Lord aroused the hostility of the Philistines and of the Arabs living near them. If you go back to 2 Kings, it just said, well, he reigned for 8 years and then he died. Well, here it says the Philistines came in and they invaded Judah and they carried off all the property found in the king's palace, as well as his sons, as well as his wives. He was left with no sons at all except his youngest son, Jehoahaz. And after all this calamity, the Lord afflicted him with an incurable disease of the bowels. And in due time, after about 2 years of this, his bowels protruded, mine says, they fell out, and he died in acute pain. I guess he would. His people did not make a funeral pyre for him as they had for his ancestors. He passed away, verse 20 says, unlamented, and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. Fascinating.
The message says he was totally incontinent.
I'm not even going to go there.
Mine says he died to no one's regret.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not the same. Yours talked about the disease. Yours talked about the attitude.
Yeah.
So just to give you insight.
You don't have to do this.
Basically, you develop diarrhea, and you develop diarrhea so bad
that it inverts everything.
Way down, proteins go way down, and then you get this disease where your rectum protrudes, called proxidensia.
I'm glad there's a more dignified name than what I can use.
Our translation has that word.
Good translation.
Wow. But it sounds gross and it sounds like it hurts like crazy.
I mean, it comes from a protein-losing diarrheal illness. And then you're right.
And it lasted
and
2 years.
Yuck.
Plop.
Hopefully you can do a doctor before.
I don't know why we're laughing, but I do have to admit that was my reaction. You either laugh or you do something, right? Chapter 22, the inhabitants of Jerusalem then made his youngest son Ahaziah king in succession. Why? Back in 2 Kings, you didn't see this. He's the only one left. The marauders had killed off everybody else. How old was it when he came to the throne? Verse 2 of chapter 22. 22. How long did he reign? That doesn't sound right. 1 year. And then, still in verse 2, I'm chapter 22 of 2 Chronicles, it tells you something that almost never do you see. What does it tell you? It tells you his mother's name. Barbara realized when she looked at Valentine cards for her mother that this year the Valentine cards say mama more often than mother. Did you? Have you all see that in this? Happy Valentine's Day, Mama. His mama's name was Athalia. His mama's name was Athalia. Now think back to where this guy came from, right? This guy's daddy had married Ahab's daughter, right? So granddaddy's Omri, daddy is Ahab. And here's Athalia. And he is just totally influenced by Mama and by others of Ahab's family. He did, verse 4, what is displeasing to the Lord, begins to talk about this. Now what did he do? He went and picked a fight with Hazael. That didn't go very well. Jehoram of Judah was injured. And Ahaziah goes and visits him. Right? And if you look at verse 7 of chapter 22, you see something you didn't see in 2 Kings, although it was implied. Through this visit to Jehoram, God brought ruin on Ahaziah. Then it talks about all these things that left. Now, when you get to here, chapter 9 says Jehoram had already been killed, but this one was captured, taken to Jehu, who put him to death. They did give Ahaziah a burial because they said he was the grandson of Jehoshaphat who sought the Lord with all his heart. And as a result, this again is not in 2 Kings, there was no member of Ahaziah's family left who was strong enough to rule the country. So who did rule the country? Mama. And every evil mama that you've seen in Disney cartoons comes out like crazy. And what was the first thing she did? Verse 10, verse 11. What was the first thing she did? She killed everybody that might be a rival to her for a claim to the throne. But the daughter of the king, I can't tell if it's her daughter or maybe the daughter of the king by a different woman, surreptitiously rescued Joash, son of Ahaziah, from among the chiefs who were to be murdered. Put him with his nurse in the sleeping quarters. Now, why would somebody have a nurse? They're a child. How small is this child? We're going to find out later, 1 year old or less. Hit him with the nurse, and in this way, she brought him and hid him from Athalia. Now, it says in here, this woman was, I got it wrong in the first hour, I'll get it right here. She was the wife of the head of all the priests. So eventually, where were they going to hide him? I'm now at the tail end of verse 12. Where did they hide him? In the temple of God. And you ask yourself, how could they possibly hide him there? The woman who rescued him was the wife of the chief priest who managed everything in the temple. So they found a corner and kept him there and managed to keep him alive. How long did they keep him there?
6 years.
6 years while Athaliah governed the country. Now, that's roughly where we would have left off. So we're now following Chronicles. We could have gone back and looked at this in Kings. You won't necessarily see exactly the same thing, but it's pretty close. And here's what happens. Jehoiada, who is the head of the priests, the husband of the woman who rescued this little boy, lets enough time go by to where the kid is 7 years old. He gets every commander of the temple guard as well as the military guard, all the different ships, there's ones that would be on, all the ones that are out in the countryside, he gets the commanders to come in. And after they're all in and they all swear an oath, he shows them the surviving boy. There is a member of the royal family who's still alive. And this is the one who should be king, and Athaliah shouldn't be. And what happens then is that they proclaim the little kid king. You can actually see this in verse 12 here, chapter 23 of 2 Chronicles. There's a parallel place in 2 Kings where you can see it. All the people are shouting. You declare somebody as king, you start blowing the trumpets, you start having all this big stuff. Well, Athaliah hears it. She comes running to find out what's happening. She looks, and there everything is. And the tail end of verse 13, she tore her clothes and shouted. That's the same thing that they shouted back earlier when Ahaziah and Jehoram were being killed by Jehu. Treason, treason, she tries. Jehoiada gave the troops orders, and the orders were take her out of the temple where the coronation had taken place, take her out of the temple and kill her, and anybody that tries to come to her aid, kill them too. And she does. Verse 16 of 2 Chronicles needs to be looked against. Let me try to find the right place. Verse 17 of 2 Kings 11. Jehoiada leads in the making of a covenant. Here in 2 Chronicles, who's the covenant between? Verse 16 of chapter 23 of 2 Chronicles. Who's the covenant? Who are the parties to the covenant? Who does it say? Himself, all the people, and the king. And what's the purpose of the covenant? That they would all, mine says, remain God's people. Is that what yours shows? You go back to 2 Kings chapter 11, verse 20, I think it is. There is a crucial, verse 17, excuse me. There's a crucial difference. Who's the covenant between? 2 Kings 11, 17. Who's the covenant between?
The Lord.
The Lord and the king and the people. And he makes a separate covenant between the king and the people. The civil matters are going to be taken care of by one covenant. The spiritual matters are taken care of by the big one. I think 2 Kings has it right. I'm not sure exactly why the language in verse 16 of 2 Chronicles 23 is what it is. Okay? Verse 17, what's the first thing the people do in response? I'm still in 2 Chronicles 23. Verse 17. There's a temple to Baal, and they destroy that temple, and they kill the priest of Baal. So there's a priest, there's a temple of Baal in Samaria. That's a big one. There's a temple of Baal here. There's a whole bunch of people up there. There's at least one here that's dying in the process. But Baal worship is being put down. If you follow what happens, this new king, how old is he when he comes to the throne? This is verse 1 of chapter 24 of 2 Chronicles.
Seven
years old. And there's a fascinating statement. You don't see this statement this way back in 2 Kings 11. You see it this way here. It says in verse 2, Joash, or Jehoash, did what the Lord regards as right. And then what does it say?
All the days that he was back as priest.
As long as Jehoiada was leading him. Throughout the days of Jehoiada. He's 7 years old. Jehoiada and Jehoiada's wife have protected him, have nurtured him, have kept him safe, have brought him to the throne. And as long as Jehoiada was alive, this kid followed God's way. Verse 17 of chapter 24. What happens? Jehoiada's dead. And what does it say? 2 Chronicles 24, 17. Officials of Judah came to pay court to the king, and the king listened to their advice. They abandoned the temple of the Lord, for the worship of sacred poles and idols. And Judah and Jerusalem incurred wrath from God because of this guilt of theirs. Verse 20, God sends his spirit on who? Zechariah. This is not the Zechariah for whom there's a book named over in the Minor Prophets. That's a different person. But it came on Zechariah. What does it say this Zechariah was? Son of Jehoadad, the chief priest, whose wife had protected and rescued Joash. The Spirit of God came on Zechariah, and he stood up before the people and said, "Why transgress the Lord's commands to your certain ruin? If you abandon the Lord, he will abandon you." And at the king's instigation, they plot against Zechariah and they stone him on the steps of the temple. And when the end of this chapter comes, what you find is the retainers of the king rebel against the king, and to avenge the death of Zechariah, they kill the king. And that's the way all of this ends. That means that we're going to start next time at 2 Chronicles 25. And we're going to start next time at 2 Kings chapter 13. And we're going to see what happens from there. I don't see a whole lot of spiritual high points in what we've just seen. But I will tell you what I have seen. I've seen something that looks a whole lot like the world we live in. You start looking through this part, and what you find is every once in a while, one of the kings seems to get it. He begins to understand who God is, begins to understand that's the way to live, but he can't always get the people to come along with him. Other times, the prophets or the people begin to see what God is doing and begin to line up, but they're in opposition to the king. It's really rare for the leadership and the people to be aligned together. That's, at the same time, that's really rare. It happens only a couple of times, and it doesn't last. That's the story of Scripture, but I fear that's also the story of the world we live in. And I don't know what to do with that thought, other than just make it. Yes, sir?
Sometimes I have kind of odd thoughts talking to teachers. And one of the struck me today was, God allowed them to have kings, but that was the people's choice, that wasn't God.
Way back when, that's what Samuel said.
Seen, all these bad kings, and they thought of, well, maybe we should have a king.
No, it's not a thought.
I've struck me that God is always there. Anytime they turn back, anytime they look for him, he's there, waiting.
And he's ready for an individual to turn back. He's ready for a family to turn back. And he makes promises. Remember that promise that you saw for Jeroboam? I will make your family and your lineage as great as David's if you just follow me and lead my people properly. And Jeroboam couldn't do it. He set up the golden calves almost immediately and everything went off the rails. I want you to join me in praying for our church, because we're experiencing a leadership change. Pray for our city or our county. Pray for our state. Pray for our nation. Pray for our world, that we would have leaders that begin to understand who God is and hear his voice, recognize it for what it is, and begin to respond. And that the leaders will find people also hearing God's voice. Because that's the hope we have. That's the hope we have. So let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, today we've seen the calamities that seem to come just right on the heels of the last calamity, when people pay little attention to who you are or deliberately turn away. We see signs of this in the world we live in, and we see relatively few of our leaders who seem to understand who you are, and we recognize in ourselves the tendency to go our own way. Help us all come to our senses. Help us begin to understand our hope is in you and in following your Son. For we ask this in your Son's name.